You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. Florida was just in, I guess, recently in Okinawa. How about that? And he was awesome. Yeah, how about that? So, good Friday morning to you, the 22nd day of February, 2019. Mike McNamara with you. You're going to hear some audio this morning from reporting of different reporters on Iwo Jima. So, I was sitting here listening to it, and, you know, you hear one of those. First of all, the stuff is so good in terms of, you know, American history. And so, you know, you hear one of the Marine Combat correspondents say, you know, he gave his name. This is Alvin Giuseppe reporting from Iwo Jima. So, I looked him up. I looked up his life. And he lived an amazing life, Alvin Giuseppe. Hell, he lived an amazing life before he got to Iwo Jima. And then after Iwo Jima, I'll tell you about his life here. But in one of the interviews, I don't know if it's he or another correspondent, and you'll hear it here in a few minutes. He asks, he's talking to a Navy doctor about, you know, how things have gone on Iwo Jima. I think the doctor's one of the surgeons for 21st Marine Regiment. And, so he says, doctor, where are you from? And the doctor gives his address. Yeah, it's like, it makes you laugh, right? I'm from 328 North 53rd Street in New York City, or something like that. He gives his home address. Oh, my God, it's hilarious. No, I don't know. Maybe you could say, well, you know, his first experience in combat and on Iwo Jima so maybe a little bit, like, out of sorts. But it's just a piece of Americana, right? It's a piece of American history. And also, when you hear this kind of montage, and it's about 20 minutes of reporting too, so it's cool. It takes you back how the American public heard about Iwo Jima and what they heard about Iwo Jima and who they heard it from. And people like Alvin Giuseppe. And Alvin Giuseppe comes home, and he's a journalist. And I'll take you through his career a little bit. But ultimately, he becomes the most renowned non-native Native American historian in the United States. He winds up living in Montana, and so, you know, it's just interesting. You hear a name and you begin to do a search on it, and then you find this life that this Marine combat correspondent led, and so very, very cool, very, very cool stuff. So so we're talking about a little bit about Iwo Jima. The anniversary of both flag raisings is tomorrow, the 23rd of February, and so a day that is iconic in Marine Corps history, but ultimately a day that was, you know, in terms of combat operations, Mount Suribachi was this, you know, supposedly this impregnable fortified position. And the 5th Marine Division, 28th Marine Regiment in particular, there's a book out about them called Lions of Iwo Jima that is well worth the read. It's a wonderful read, too, by the way. I read it on my way to Afghanistan, and I love the book because it's rich with the stories of Marines, and to include Colonel Leversage, right? Famous in Marine Corps history. He him throwing a slot machine that pissed him off through a window in Hawaii. They had the Lions of Iwo Jima comes from a story I've told before, but a corpsman with the regiment when they were here in Southern California bought a lion cub, thinking that was a good idea, from like the Los Angeles Zoo somehow. I don't exactly know how that happens, but anyway, it did. His wife says, yeah, that's not staying in this house. So what else does he do? He takes the lion to work. So they have this lion cub at Camp Pendleton, and now they're going to go to Hawaii. And so they say, what are we going to do with it? Well, let's take him with us. So they crate him up, and they take him to Hawaii. So the lion goes into quarantine in Hawaii, and then comes out of quarantine, and they have this lion, right, with the regiment. And they do parades, like the duty company does a parade through Hilo, Hawaii every day. So they have the little band, I don't know if they had the regimental or division band, and part of the band would go, and the duty company would go, and they'd do this parade. And guess who else would go? The damn lion goes. There's pictures of them training, and there's a picture I love. The first sergeant is using the lion's tail to swish shaving cream in a cup. Yeah, I kid you not. It's hilarious. And so the book is, you know, is as it tells the tale of the 28th Marines and ultimately the way they were organized and trained with a lot of combat veterans, a lot of guys who'd been Marine Raiders, a lot of guys who'd been paramarines in the early days of the war for the mission that they were going to get, which was the taking of Mount Suribachi. But ultimately, right, between the 4 days of fighting that lead up to the 23rd, and the pounding that Mount Suribachi got, you had the Japanese, there was no fight on the way up the mountain, right? The first patrol gets ready to go up, you know, and you know, nobody expects them to get to the top of the hill. That's their task, but nobody expects them really to get there. And they walk up to the top of the hill, and nary a shot fired. They get up there, and they grab a pole, and they put the flag up, the first one, smaller flag. And then there's some skirmishing as the Japanese stick their heads out on top of the hill. And then the second flag, there's one, you know, I don't know how, you know, maybe an hour or two. And then the working party goes up the hill that becomes the second set of flag raisers. They go up with a bigger flag because Chandler Johnson doesn't want the first one to get stolen. So they go get it. The story of the second flag is what? It was off the USS Oklahoma or Pennsylvania. It was off a ship that was at Pearl Harbor. The flag had been given to one of the landing craft, the LCUs or the LCMs, one of those things. And so they went down to get a bigger flag, and they said, "Hey, we need a flag." And they're like, "Here, take this one." And so that one went up to the top of the hill, and they found an irrigation pipe, and they you see the pictures of them trying to take probably comm wire or some whatever they would use, comm wire, rope, something, and tie that thing to the pole, and when they get it done, they stick in the ground, and they stick in the ground and stand it up. And in the blink of an eye, a picture's taken, and it becomes the image of the Marine Corps for history, and one of the most produced images in the world. So crazy. So that the anniversary, the 74th anniversary of that, is tomorrow. And so just kind of a little piece of Marine Corps history that I wandered into this morning as I listened to Alvin Josephy on the island of Iwo Jima. And so I was reading about him. He first goes ashore in the Battle of Guam, and he has a condom over his microphone as he's recording. And what must have been a reel-to-reel recorder, because I think that's the only way they did it. I'm not sure, right? And he had to have jury-rigged it so it would be battery-operated, right? I don't think they made a whole lot of those devices at the time. So anyway, he's waiting ashore with his microphone and a condom over his microphone. And he said, because I was narrating it, I don't think I got as scared as I would have had I not been narrating it. So I was working and doing play-by-play. And so as a result, I think it kind of detached me from the dangers of what were going on around me. So pretty interesting. But again, that's just kind of the gateway into Alvin Josephy's life. So who is Alvin Josephy? We'll find out about him. We'll check the news of the day. The chef will join us. Mike's going to join us. So all of that coming up here on a Friday edition of All Marine Radio. The my boy George weighing in from Texas. What's up, George? Good morning. That's right. Good to see you're alive and kicking out there. So anyway, without further ado, Whitney Houston sings the national anthem this morning. Good morning to you. Alabama, they're drinking tea with lemon and honey. Just so you know. So that's going on. That's going around on the country. So if you want to chime in wherever you're at, feel free. And this is dedicated to the Marines 74 years ago that went up that hill. Of Mount Suribachi. And many of them did not survive the battle. And so we who've lived in their long shadow have always looked up to their courage and selflessness, guys who went ashore, not only on that island, but guys who wrote Marine Corps history like it had never been written prior to that. We had brief chapters in World War One, but the history of the Marine Corps that was written in World War Two would fundamentally change it and affect a lot of us who came afterwards. So the guys who went up that hill were just normal American, guys who did their duty, and some of them paid with their lives. So this is dedicated to all of them. And as a Marine who's always looked up to that flag raising, what it meant, and what that meant to the Marine Corps. So this is for them.
Betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
It defines us. It defines warriors like Gunnery Sergeant John Canley, a leader who led from the front. With his Marines outnumbered, he pushed forward during the Battle of Way City, standing tall during firefights and throwing himself into harm's way to keep his fellow Marines safe.
The only thing I was doing was just responding. The Marines, the young Marines, it shows them that it's not do as I say, it's do as I do. And just being that close with them brings motivation to them.
During firefights, when we'd be all hugging Mother Earth, he'd be standing up directing us. And I think if you talk to every Alpha Company Marine, we're amazed that he was never shot.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore, so young folks, you ignore what I just said.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
I had a Vietnam vet tell me one time, Jeremiah, he goes, PTSD, it's like having a cage in your brain. It's like having a cage full of monkeys. The goal is to keep the monkeys in the cage, because once the bastards make the jailbreak, all hell breaks loose, so you want to keep them in the cage.
Once you're out of the Corps, it's your responsibility to live your life in a way that would honor those that were with you and died. I mean, don't waste your life. Goodness, do something meaningful, and don't be going out there saying, look, oh, woe is me. I'm a poor veteran, or I'm a disabled veteran. Well, yeah, I am a disabled veteran. But, you know, we can't have that kind of attitude. We've got to show people that, hey, we care about our country. We care about what happens to everyone. Brain Corps changed me. It made me a better man, but I don't know a Marine that wouldn't tell you the same thing, Mike.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. We got to win.
Tell you what, we are losing the weather fight out here, man. You know, I didn't even know it because I tend to have my head down. But it snowed in Los Angeles yesterday, night before, something like that, when it rained. Yeah, up in the northern part of Los Angeles. Yeah, go figure, huh? Anyway, cloudy in 46 in Quantico. Camp Lejeune is cloudy in 54. Granbury, Texas, fog in 50. In 29 Palms, sunny and 36. That's right, you heard me. But listen to this. When it's colder at Pendleton than it is in 29 Palms, something's terribly wrong. Camp Pendleton, sunny in 34. What? Dark cloudy in 66 in Okinawa. In the Al-Anbar province of Iraq, it is dark cloudy in 62, so it's warmed up there. In the Helmand province of Afghanistan, dark cloudy at 49, so colder there. In the Costa Mesa, Newport Beach area. Now, mind you, that temperature from Pendleton, I believe, comes from the airfield, which is on the east side of the mountains. So on the west side of the mountains, nearer the coast, normally warmer. And it is. It's 38 degrees in Newport Beach, Costa Mesa. Okay? That's a friggin' crisis. I'm not going to lie to you. Yeah, I just said friggin' for the first time in my life, I think. When I'm not quoting somebody else. That's a tribute to how cold it is. Yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, you're going to hear almost 20 minutes of reporting from Iwo Jima. And honestly, I love this stuff because it's American history. And it's the way that our, you know, my grandparents, my dad would have been 32. Let's see, he would have been 10, 11, something like that, if he was listening. And then my mom, she would have been 8 or 9, something like that. But my grandparents sitting around listening to the reports coming back on the radio of what was going on in the Pacific and in Europe and in Africa, all that going on. So you'll get a chance to experience that. And again, it's a montage of clips from Airfield Number 1. I think it starts out there from talking to a physician, as I said, who gives us home address, his street address. The first B-29 bomber crew that landed on Iwo Jima gets interviewed. So that's kind of interesting. Bill Ross is with the 3rd Marine Division, and you hear a couple different clips from him. He's an author, right, of I think the book's called Iwo, Common Men, Uncommon Valor, might be, if I'm not mistaken. And stories about puppies, about war dogs and having babies and things like that. So it's just an interesting montage. And then there's also a solemnness at the way the reporters who are, some of them seeing this stuff for the first time, some of them not seeing it for the first time, but as they try to bring this snapshot of what's going on this island of death back to the American people. So don't touch that dial, because what you'll hear next is pretty cool. More of All Marine Radio coming up on this Friday on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network, next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it. The McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Read Board page at allmarineradio.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs at allmarineradio.com. And I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
A message from DAV to all returning veterans. Thank you. Thank you for doing your duty. Thank you for doing our bidding. Thank you for laying it all on the line. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting your future on hold to put our enemies on notice. Thank you for putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way. Thank you for defending our freedom, for displaying your honor, for being a hero, even though you don't want to be called one. For all this and more, DAV thanks you, and we're here to help you. Expert DAV advisors will make sure you get the health, disability, and financial benefits you were promised and earned. If you're a veteran, visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in the crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
It'll be kind of like being a pilot.
you'll come out of college and you want a cyber guarantee, and we'll give you a cyber guarantee.
Great.
And then if you make it through the school, then you'll get qualified, and that's what you'll go do. If you don't, then we'll
room in the grunts.
Make you an infantry officer.
Worked okay for you and
worked
me.
Out for
so.
You. Of course, everyone knows that the most intelligent, handsome people on the earth are infantry officers.
As this would convey.
Exhibit A and B.
That's right.
Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara.
Ooh.
And you're listening to my dad.
That's right.
On All Marine Radio.
Mm-hmm.
On the All Warrior Radio Network.
Well done, girlfriend. All right, we get going on a Friday morning. The let me just tell you who Alvin Josephi is. So you're gonna hear his voice here in a minute. So I looked up. Well, first of all, how do you spell Josephi? Right, Alvin though, that's a pretty unique name. So I figured maybe you know like when you do a search, it'll give you did you mean this? And so it's actually spelled J O. It could be Italian, right? J. Then how do the Italians spell it? J-O-S-E-F-F-I, Josephi, J-O-S-E-P-H-I. It's actually spelled J-O-S-E-P-H-Y, Alvin Josephi. He became a writer. He wrote about the Marine Corps, about his experience in the Marine Corps, a book called The Long and the Short and the Tall, Marines in Combat on Guam and Iwo Jima. You can find that on Amazon for hardcover $15.94 and paperback $31.22. Yeah. He's a Marine sergeant and war correspondent with the 3rd Marine Division. So that's the book he wrote about his experience as a Marine. I told you though that he was considered the foremost authority on Native American history, who was not a Native American, so a non-Native American. He wrote the following: The Nez Perce Indians and the Opening of the Northwest Passage. 500 Nations, an Illustrated History of North American Indians. Lewis and Clark Through the Eyes of 9 Indian Writers on the Legacy of the Expedition. The Patriot Chiefs, a Chronicle of American Indian Resistance. Yeah, how about that? Red Power, 2nd Edition, The American Indians Fight for Freedom. Civil War in the American West. So he went on to be, you know, a prolific writer about, I think, and I don't know if he was from Montana. I haven't got that far yet. But he lived in Montana. And one other book, Nez Perce Summer, 1877, The U.S. Army and the Nemi-Poo Crisis. So, so you're going to hear his voice here in a second. And then you see pictures of him, right? Picture of him, a painting of him in his alphas, and then him standing next to it. A picture of he and John Kennedy meeting at some kind of cultural event where he's with John Kennedy. A picture of him interviewing a Navy nurse who arrived on Iwo Jima, and it looks like he's still got the condom covering the microphone. But it's an odd picture when you look at it, because here's this woman. No, it's not a condom. It's just a shiny microphone. Here's a woman on Iwo Jima. So odd. And then there's a couple other pictures of him. He with friends. On Iwo Jima, sitting there smiling with at some kind of probably before they left the island. So there's a picture that says something about combat correspondents only. In combat correspondents only are allowed in this hole, Right. I'm sure that got respected by a lot of people. And here's a little bit about him, right? Alvin Giuseppe Jr. He's talked about living in Montana, in the Wallowa Mountains of Montana, that he loved. He visited Montana for the first time in 1955. He had dropped out of Harvard. He had worked as a screenwriter at Hollywood. At the age of 22, he interviewed Soviet Marxist revolutionary Leon Trotsky and Mexico's president Lázaro Cárdenas del Río. He had worked for the New York Herald Tribune. He fought in the South Pacific during World War II, recording the landings on Guam. And don't even mention Iwo Jima. And landed a job at Time Magazine and had 4 kids from 2 marriages. His daughter said no matter how storied his life had been up to that point, she believed that he was most content sitting on the top of his horse looking over the Wallowa Valley, though he wasn't much of a horseman. So it's just a really, really interesting story about a guy whose voice you're going to hear right now. So then he goes on. So I'm looking it up. There's a library named in his name, Alvin M. and Betty Giuseppe Library of Western History and Culture, and it has a series of pictures of him as as he grew, but there's a couple of pictures of him in the South Pacific, which are pretty interesting pictures. And there's a picture, as I said, of him with President Kennedy. So, anyway. Let me get this. Let me get this ready here. So, stand by while I unscrew myself. Be patient. Trust me, it's worth it. All right. With all that buildup, here you go.
This is Staff Sergeant Alvin Giuseppe Jr. We are on one of the runways of Motoyama Airfield Number 1. And all around us is a scene of desolation and death. At the edge of the airfield are abutments in which our troops, our different command posts, have taken sanctuary. They have hidden behind them to keep out of range of mortars and flying bullets, which are coming from just up ahead. The last abutment back houses an aid station. And just in front of the aid station are stretches on which must be about 50 dead Marines. They are being taken back for burial in our new cemeteries just beginning here. It is a dreadful sight, and one which would sober any person seeing it for the first time. These men are lying out in their camouflage ponchos and shoulder halves on stretchers. They have been brought back from the front lines, and the aid station men are caring for their remains with very great tenderness. They are being put aboard trucks and recons to be taken back now to the cemeteries. This is a dreadful, desolate, ugly island. The dirt is sort of a grayish, yellowish, volcanic ash. Very soft and crumbly, and when you dig a foxhole, the sides keep coming in on you. There is very little vegetation because practically nothing grows here. It has to struggle. It has too great a struggle with the volcanic ash. Now we conclude this description of this little piece of hell on Iwo Jima.
Men in battle come up with some odd supply requirements. Often there's a Red Cross field man nearby who tries to figure out some answer to them. This was the case on Iwo Jima, where Bruce Thomas of the Red Cross had to use all kinds of shortcuts to give the Marines what they wanted. Here he is to tell about a few incidents that took place on Iwo Jima.
I'll bet 9 out of every 10 Marines has a Zippo lighter, including myself. So by D+5, everyone was out of fluid, and they came around to us to see what we could do. Well, that's my job. It's up to me to find substitutes, something neither the Red Cross nor the Marine Corps have what we need. So we find it somewhere, somehow. And on this matter of lighter fluid, I found some high-octane white gasoline. You have to use white gas because leaded gas will clog the lighter. And I obtained 5 precious gallons. We put this up in small brandy bottles that had been tossed aside by the medical corps, and we had quite a monopoly on lighter fluid.
Did you find any gas equipment you could use?
No, that's all turned over to the military authorities. But I wouldn't use any anyhow. It's too dangerous. A lot of boys have run into booby traps that way.
But the Japs don't use booby traps as much as the Germans, do they?
No. No, I guess they don't, but they're crazy fighters. You can't predict what they'll do. They'll advance when they haven't a chance. They'll retreat when they don't have to. You just never know. My favorite story of the whole campaign concerns a typical stunt of the Japs. They were shooting off rockets. It was a very strange experience to meet with this kind of Jap stupidity, for you see, we'd be in our foxholes and hear these rockets being fired, and everyone would crouch down thinking it would explode the whole area. Well, nothing happened. We didn't crawl out to see why. We just stayed right in our foxholes. But the next morning, the Marine experts would go out and find that the Japs had fired the propeller part of the bomb and had forgotten to put the head on. There wasn't any explosive in it. And yet, with obvious stupid tricks like these, the Japs are fanatical fighters. They get in their foxholes and you can't get them out. They fight like mad.
This is Staff Sergeant Alvin Giuseppe, Jr. We are with a battalion aid station of the 21st Marines, just behind the front lines on Iwo. What is your name, Doctor?
Dr. Harry S. Mustard, Jr.
And where are you from?
325 East 72nd Street, New York City.
Well, Doctor, what was the first thing that happened here that put you on edge?
Oh, when it first came up here, yeah, there were shells falling all over the place, but it set fire.
Then you had some real casualties here, didn't you?
That's quite a few of them. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, in reserve, the regiment, the battalion rather kept on having casualties. Other outfits now, carry kept having casualties. One on the hill just in depth, and casualties were brought back in for treatment while we were under fire. Had quite a few casualties there.
And you had to take care of those men. And were there any dead men in that?
Yes, quite a few dead men. I think there were 2 in all, and several bad casualties probably down later on.
What's your name and race?
Thomas J. Kyle. Thomas is my first class, USM.
And where are you from, Tom?
Rockdale, Texas.
What happened?
Well, when I first known him, I heard a terrific racket, and I saw a lot of debris going high in the air. I thought it was a shell at first, and later they told me it was a mine that just held such that it exploded on the airfield. We noticed patients laying out there, all burned, and 3 of us ran across and to get them and bring them back into our aid station.
Well, now, you may not want to say that, but actually going out there to get those men back meant exposing themselves to fire and mortar from mortars and all kinds of small arms. But you did bring them back and took care of them. Did you get any rest?
No, we didn't get much rest. Things happened pretty fast that day around here. We just opened our last can of milk, and shrapnel punctured a hole right near the bottom, and it all drained out on us.
We delay the program schedule for this time to bring you a special news report from Guam. For the first time in this war,
you pull out your last can of milk, and it had been punctured by, you know, shrapnel. But the doctor who gives his home address, I mean, it's just the way they talk and the way they speak is very cool and very, you know, it's obviously the way our culture at the time.
29 Super Fortress has landed on Iwo Jima. By the sheerest accident, one of the big sky bombers roared down on the tiny island where heavy hand-to-hand fighting is taking place. But now we call in war correspondent John Hooley on Guam. Go ahead, Guam.
This is Guam. Here are two men of the B-29 crew. They're here to tell the hair-raising story of the first super fortress to land on Iwo Jima.
On one side of me sits Lieutenant Raymond Fred Malo of Danville, Illinois, and on the other, Sergeant James Cox from Marion, Kansas.
Lieutenant Malo is pilot of the Iwo Weenie, named after the exploit, and Sergeant Cox is a radio operator.
The Iwo Weenie landed on Iwo Jima yesterday
and took off 4 hours later.
The sergeant, by the way, isn't a talkative person, so you're going to have to help out, Fred.
Sure, this is Fred Malo. How about saying hello, Jim?
Hello, everybody. This is Sergeant Cox.
Good start. Now, tell me, how'd you happen to be up over Iwo Jima anyway?
We were returning from Sunday's big strike on Tokyo. Our first mission, by the way. Sergeant Cox and I came out here as private crew 2 weeks ago, and this is our first big job.
At first, we knew we couldn't make our base with about 360 miles out of Tokyo on the home run. The mom-made doors wouldn't shut after we made the run, and they dragged so much that we were using up gasoline too fast.
I passed the word to throw out the loose equipment in case we had to make a water landing, so no one would get hurt.
We tossed overboard all flak suits, the camera, and expended all our ammunition to lighten the ship.
I told Cox to use emergency rescue procedure.
But the best I could do was to contact the flag control at Iwo Jima.
And what did they say?
They asked what the trouble was. When I told them we were low on fuel and had jammed the bomb bay doors, they asked us whether we wanted to chance it to land on the strip. Lieutenant Mayo told me to say we would land by the strip.
You say we didn't want to lose the ship, and after all, a water landing is dangerous.
Well, now we've got you to Iwo Jima.
That's where Lieutenant Mayo took over.
We had to make 3 passes to feel 4 feet from the ground to even get an idea what it would be like.
How much airstrip does a B-29 need?
About twice as much as I could see down there.
But you came down okay.
That's right. Everybody held on tight, and I came in alongside Mount Suribachi. After using up about 600 feet of runway, we touched down. Right away, I put on a hydraulic brake, and co-pilot Lieutenant Ed Mockler of Park Falls, Wisconsin, pulled on the emergency brake.
Everything turned out fine?
Oh, sure. We knocked down the wind speed at the end of the runway, but the Iwo Weenie skid to a stop, and we stayed on the strip.
I hear you made quite a sensation.
You're right. Before we got our breath back, we were surrounded by Marines and construction men. They were lining the field when we came in.
And how long were you on the strip?
About 4 hours. We got off there as soon as we could. After we burned some gas, we decided to try a takeoff.
That was just before dark.
Yes, I gunned the motors. There's a lot of horsepower in 4 B-29 engines and held the brakes. Then just when we were turning over at full power, I let go of the brakes and we started out like a shot. It was like a catapult. We got off all right and flew on down our base without any trouble.
So you saw Iwo Jima and Tokyo all in one day, and on your first mission, too.
That was exciting enough for 10 missions.
Those Marines up there were swell. And I want to say a word for my crew, too. We couldn't have done it without everybody working in a team.
Right? How funny, right? I mean, you hear him talk, and he gives, what, the bombardier's name? And, you know, Mike Musselman from, you know, whatever, Fergus Falls, Wisconsin. Whatever the hell he said. Just funny.
Buck Foster speaking from the flagship of Admiral Kelly Turner off Iwo Jima. After 6 days of touch and go situations on this island, the Marines of B-26 seem to have themselves well established and are now launching what may well be the final manned drive to break the backbone of remaining organized Japanese resistance at the northern end of the island. American confidence that the southern half of the island no longer offers any real threat to American shed or invasion vessels offshore has been exemplified as the entire fleet, with but few exceptions, has moved to within a few hundred yards of the shoreline, within easy range of any remaining Jap artillery or mortars from the Suribachi area. Jap heavy aircraft fire brought down one of our Navy planes this morning. Never has less than a half dozen American planes which have fallen victim to the battle. I watched him circle over the center of the island, saw a burst of ACAC, then the engine caught fire, and the long trail of heavy black smoke bloomed out as he made his way out to sea to escape falling among our ships offshore. But the pilot must have been hit. off the northern end of the island, he suddenly went into a dive and plunged into the ocean close to our transport. A big explosion followed. A little smoke and fire for a few minutes was all that marked the water's very own place of those Americans. I thought to myself, General Sherman was certainly a master of understatement. This is Buck Foster speaking for the combined American radio network.
What's been happening since the historic day when the Stars and Stripes were planted on Suribachi? We hear now from Marine Combat Correspondent Bill Ross with the 3rd Division, speaking near one of the rebuilt airfields on Iwo.
This island during the past month has had its face lifted. Virtually nothing about Iwo remains the same as it was when the Marines landed. On Suribachi, the 500-meter-high extinct volcano on the southern tip of the island, even it presents a vastly different picture than it did on D-Day and the days immediately following. When the Leatherneck first stormed the almost sheer slopes of the small mountain, nothing but rocky paths led to its summit. Now a modern American road zigzags back and forth through the pinnacle where the Stars and Stripes first were implanted on Iwo Jima. The Japanese, since they owned Iwo, and no one can remember when they didn't, the Japanese hadn't bothered to construct roads to any great degree here. Already there's a network of miniature American highways that carry the jeeps and trucks and other vehicles almost everywhere they care to go. Most certainly, there were no traffic cops on Iwo when we came ashore, but we have them here now. An MP is situated at virtually every intersection on the island's road network, directing traffic and seeing that the island's 15-mile-an-hour speed limit is observed. Not only has the ownership and management of Iwo Jima changed, but the island itself, and the change is for the better.
You may think you know what Iwo Jima was like, and perhaps you do. For a vivid close-up of several incidents which he witnessed on Iwo, let's hear what Leslie Nichols had to say upon his return to Guam.
Never have I seen life and death in such close embrace as on Iwo Jima. I doubt if there are 10 square feet on the island that have not been soaked with American or Japanese blood. The day before yesterday, I visited several battalions of the 5th Marine Division just behind the front lines. At one point, we had to cross an open field to reach a company which was resting at the base of a low ridge. Unflushed Jap snipers were able to cover this area from positions in caves. Bullets pinged across as we raced for the ridge. I jumped for a dugout and landed in the lap of a Marine. He turned out to be Captain Aram Rajabian. Captain Rajabian led his company in that final push yesterday, and I hope he made out well. His company was going in to relieve another, which had lost 8 successive commanders. A private first class was the 9th to take over. I wanted to meet the private and hear his story. Just then, 2 stretcher bearers sneaked around the ridge and passed us on the way to the first aid station. Someone said to me, "There's your company commander." I stepped up and asked one of the corpsmen how the private was getting along. The stretcher bearer stopped a moment. The corpsman lifted the blanket and said, "He just died." I fell into conversation with one of the wounded lying on the ground. As with nearly all Marines, he was cheerful. No complaints, no whimpering. This corporal was proud of the Japanese flag he had found on D-Day plus 10. He had stuffed it into his shirt front and carried it everywhere. When he fell from a Jap bullet yesterday morning, he had tied the flag around his bare leg, just for safekeeping. But the doctor had to take it off. So the corporal asked me to reach under the blanket for a small gunny sack containing his personal belongings. He wanted me to see his Jap flag. I looked in the sack, but there was no flag. I had to tell him. I searched all around the stretcher, still no flag. Evidently, it had been stolen. The corporal looked up at me, and there was grief in his eyes. "I killed 3 Japs before I got that flag," he said. "I wanted to give it to my dad to put up on the wall over the fireplace. Now it's gone, and I'm leaving Iwo Jima." He turned his head slightly, and the tears began to flow, and I had to turn my head, too, because I thought I would cry.
Not all the heroes of the Pacific are men. Recently, when Marine Combat Correspondent Sergeant Bill Ross came across 9 new puppies being cared for by the men of the 3rd Marine Division, he inquired further, and he learned that the deceased father had been a hero on Iwo, along with his master. Here is Sergeant Ross with the 3rd Division somewhere in the Pacific.
There's a new family with our outfit today, a family that numbers 9 in all. The father of the clan was a well-known figure in the 3rd Division. I say was a well-known figure because he was killed on Iwo Jima. His name was Rusty, and he was a Marine war dog. A new family is his puppies, which he never saw. Rusty, since his death, has become somewhat of a legend to the men of the 3rd. For among the sulfur caves and rugged hills of northern Iwo, he gave his life in a vain attempt to save the life of his handler. It happened just before the close of the campaign. Rusty and his master, Private First Class Walter Josephek of Detroit, Michigan, were leading a patrol which already had cleaned out two small nests of Japs. When they moved in on the third pocket, a heavily defended cave, Marine Josephek was hit by rifle fire and dropped to the ground with a wound in his leg. The Detroit man was unable to move because of the wound and the rough terrain. He called for the other Marines to call the dog to safety, but Rusty refused to leave. He stood his ground between his master and the enemy, snarling defiance at the Japs. The enemy troops in the cave seemed to sense that their time had come, but they were determined to fight to the last. They kept firing at Josephek and the other Marines, and hand grenades became a potent weapon in the skirmish. Josephek and Rusty remained in the hot spot between the battling troops. And when a Jap grenade landed in front of the Detroit man, the dog took the full impact of the blast. Without whimpering, he slumped to the rocky ground next to his master, still between the Marine and the Japs. And there it was that Rusty died on Iwo Jima. Josephek was removed from the area as the other men in the patrol moved forward and wiped out the Japs. He died the next day. I happened on the scene of the fighting just as four Marines were placing the dog's body on a stretcher to carry it to the rear, where Rusty was buried in the 3rd Marine Division's War Dog Cemetery. The Grizzly Leathernecks picked up the dog with the same tender care they would have given a fellow Marine. "He was sure a swell dog," said one Marine, a war-tested veteran, every bit of 19 years old. So goes the story of Rusty, the father of the newest additions to the 3rd Marine Division. 9 tiny Doberman Pinscher puppies, destined to be Marine war dogs. Rusty and PFC Josephek were inseparable in life, and, in doing the job assigned to them, met death fighting the Japs on Iwo.
We are speaking to you from the summit of Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima. Last February 19th, the United States Marines established their beachhead on this grim, cruel, forbidding 8 square mile stretch of volcanic ash and lava island that lies halfway between Saipan and Tokyo. On March 16th last, Fleet Admiral Nimitz announced that organized resistance was over at Iwo Jima. It's dusty here, volcanic smoke dust that is on everything and in everything. American trucks, bulldozers, caterpillars, jeeps, every known kind of mechanical earth-moving device is adding more dust. 2 airfields have been put in operation. A few Quonset huts are going up. Acres of what once, a very short time ago, were potholes are now covered with pup tents. There is no time for amenities or any comforts of life. There are scarcely any trees, just scrub brush that is even more bedraggled than ever as a result of the wearing, blistering fighting that went on. And as highlights in these black ash and brown green brush, trim, white, symmetrical gravestone mountains, row after row of them gleam whitely in the distance. They are the graves of United States fighting men. And in the midst of sacrifice, of life, of the heat of construction, even while B-29s land, there is still potential death around. Not all the Japs on Iwo Jima are dead. Not all its honeycombs are saved and explored. The sniper bullets can come singing out of the night at any moment. But despite all this, the danger, the pressure of work, the lack of things non-fighters would consider necessities of life, even the wisps of steam that drift up through the volcanic ground itself, Iwo Jima is now American territory, and the fact that the island is ours is proven by the American flag that flies from the Central Airport. The Battle of Iwo is won. I return you to Rome.
And that's the situation today at Iwo Jima, our latest conquest. Now, for news of progress where today's fighting is, we take you to a spot less than 400 miles from the Japanese mainland, to Okinawa. Go ahead, Okinawa.
Go ahead, Okinawa. The somebody sent me a message. Mac, why is the quality of the audio so different? Some, for instance, you hear Bill Ross's. He recorded that on some kind of recording device. There, others were captured from a broadcast that was done over a radio. So it was a radio to somebody recording on the ship. And so because of the radars and different things that were emitting, you had interference, and that's the reason why you hear the sound quality that you hear. If you could have got everybody to shut their stuff off, it probably would have been relatively clear. But Navy tended not to do that. Yeah, we're not turning off the radars for you, son. So go ahead. So yeah, that's the reality of broadcasting in that kind of environment. But again, it gives you some sense. I mean, that's what the American public heard. Those are the reports that they heard, that got filed. That's what they heard back from Iwo Jima. Everything from the home address of a doctor treating wounded Marines in the 21st Regiment, to which was on the kind of the right flank as you went onto the beach, and then all the way to a story about a war dog. You know, it's interesting the affinity that Marines have for their dogs, and especially after they're killed. It can be brutal because everybody loves the dogs. It takes you to a different place. When you see the dog, it takes you home. And so you might not like everybody in your unit, but everybody likes the dog. So anyway, so a little taste of the world of the Marine Corps and of the United States 74 years ago this week and over the course of the battle. So interesting stuff. And as I continue to find that stuff, now I'm intrigued to find more of Alvin Giuseppe's reporting and Bill Ross's reporting as well. Bill Ross would go on to write Iwo Jima. I think the subtitle is Legacy of Valor. So he was a combat correspondent with the 3rd Marine Division, and just the work of the Marine Corps combat correspondents who the Marine Corps invested, you know, not a little bit, but you know, in cameras and in recording devices, so that it could document, you know, what went on in the Pacific. And so so a rich history of those guys. So anyway, we'll take a break. When we come back, we will get the All Marine Radio head chef on. So we'll talk to Kim Holmes, and we'll talk to him a little bit about food. So don't touch that dial. We continue on a day when the day before the flag raising on Iwo Jima. Yeah, I agree. Wartime news. It feels like I'm sitting in an old theater watching a wartime reel. Yeah, you can visualize that, right. But again, a different age. Now, you know, they see the actual video. They see the actual video as it, you know, not too long after it happens. That's how different the world is, right? Images come straight back from the battlefield, and it's not something that is. I don't want to say taken lightly, but it's something that you have to account for, to include not allowing cameras anymore to go on patrols and things like that, because those images are powerful images. And if you can't, and it tends not to be a good thing for that stuff to become just unfettered out there for the American public. Now, I've said, like, if Marines uploaded all their stuff onto the internet, oh my God, that would not be a good thing. So anyway, but yeah, it is very much reminiscent of seeing something in the movies. But I love to hear, right, their firsthand accounts of it, you know, and you can hear it in their voices. The one report where they're talking about 50 dead Marines in the vicinity of Airfield Number 1 and the way they're treated, to include, you know, the way they're treated, the way they handle the dog's remains. Again, I for whatever reason, I've always been a fan of that, and probably now more so than ever. So we'll take a break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, on a Friday, the All Warrior Radio Network.